Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I'm starting off with the must list this week because we have one. I'm always so happy when we do. The Fall Guy, Hacks, and The Idea of You lead this week's must list. See Entertainment Weekly's top pop culture picks for the week. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. June gloom has come early to Los Angeles, so we might as well start celebrating summer. And what better way to prepare for the sunny season than with Entertainment Weekly's summer movie preview? We kicked things off on Wednesday with our cover story featuring Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, starring Anya Taylor-Joy and Chris Hemsworth, and will continue with dozens of exclusives through the next week. Hell, if the skies remain gloomy, at least there's plenty of reasons to stay inside. That was by Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. So the first item they have on their must list this week, it's The Fall Guy. Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt bring explosive chemistry and literal explosions to this delightful action blockbuster about a down-on-his-luck stuntman, played by Gosling, who tries to rescue his director ex-girlfriend's movie after her star, Aaron Taylor Johnson, goes missing. In fact, I have the full review right here. So I'm going to read that instead of just the last few words of that promo there. The Fall Guy turns the summer blockbuster into an earnest love letter to the movies. Ryan Gosling has a vehicle tailor-made for his movie star charisma and estimable talents. This is by Maureen Lee Lanker. There's a shot near the middle of The Fall Guy where a soaking wet Ryan Gosling emerges from Sydney Harbor, a white shirt plastered to his body. Behind him, the iconic Sydney Opera House stands, bathed in the light of the raging flames of a nearby boating accident. Then my jaw dropped, and I uttered something to the effect of, "Jesus Christ!" Because Gosling and filmmaker David Leitch, himself a former stuntman, know exactly what they're doing. And it's not merely making the heart of anyone with a pulse race a little faster, although, yes, obviously. With this shot, Leitch delivers what makes The Fall Guy such a winning proposition. Gosling, at last bringing all his strengths to bear in one project, he gets to embody his full potential here as a drop-dead gorgeous leading man, an action star in a moment of triumph, and a winking comedian poking fun at his own image. In many ways, this sums up the appeal of The Fall Guy, a joyride of a summer blockbuster that packs all the right punches, from its action sequences to its chemistry-laden central romance to its meta-love for the movies and the unsung heroes who make them feel real. The film, inspired by the 1980s TV series of the same name, follows Gosling's Colt Seavers, a stuntman who suffers a terrible onset accident and then is recruited out of retirement to help rescue the debut directorial effort of his lost love, Judy Moreno, played by Emily Blunt. By tracking down missing leading man Tom Ryder, played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. But when Ryder's disappearance brings danger to Colt's door, he has to fight to save himself and the woman he loves. Gosling does, in fact, do many of his own stunts here, including riding a piece of sheet metal like a wakeboard. The credits take care to show us what was him and what was a stunt double, of which there were at least 8. The glee with which he hurls himself through glass balconies and the beauty with which he takes a punch only heighten the film's riotous sense of fun. For decades, Gosling has been bringing movie star charisma in spades, but The Fall Guy feels like a pinnacle of sorts. Colt Seavers is the apotheosis of all Gosling has to offer. His adrenaline-fueled world-weariness is a potent postmodern blend of Harrison Ford cynicism and Tom Cruise everyman machismo, with goofy, stone-faced humor as the cherry on top. From The Nice Guys to Barbie, Gosling has proven his comedic chops, But he gets to ratchet up his deadpan delivery and panache for physical comedy to the extreme here. The Fall Guy is a vehicle worthy of his multifaceted talents, and he drives it like he stole it. Who else could make crying to Taylor Swift's All Too Well 10-minute version, or being interrogated by a goon squad, so riotously funny? Gosling is perfectly paired with Blunt, who infuses Jody with brightness and grounded professionalism. It's refreshing and downright inspiring to see such a capable, brilliant female director character on screen. Blunt's Jody is not merely skillful, she's innovative and warm, neither a tyrant on her set nor a pushover. With Jody, Blunt gets to dispel the myth of the male genius director, all while sporting fashionable, Greta Gerwig-worthy jumpsuits and investing as much thought into shooting record-breaking canon roles as crafting a satisfying love story. One of which she gets herself, threading the needle of heartbreak and attraction as she wrestles with Colt's sudden return to her life. Blunt and Gosling's chemistry is the stuff of rom-com dreams, a warm, grounded affection evident between them in every scene. There's a spark there, yes, but there's also something deeper, a tenderness and intimacy that goes beyond a mere sexual connection. That's not to say they're not sexy together. Their clenches are full of passion, amped up by wind generated by helicopter blades. But they're also able to channel that chemistry into the quote-unquote calm half of the rom-com equation, making hilarious comedic bits out of heartbroken karaoke sessions and multiple unexpected reunions. We're invited to have fun right along with them. Winston Duke also shines, the imposing build that made Black Panther's M'Baku a thirst trap is repurposed into his work as loyal stunt coordinator Dan Tucker. Duke's charms and mischievous sense of humor get their time in the spotlight, especially with Dan's penchant for increasingly silly movie references, showcasing his sweeter side. If the movie has any faults, it's in its pacing, spending a hair too long on exposition. But once the real stunting begins, things move at an adrenaline-fueled clip towards its explosive ending. With The Fall Guy, Leitch has composed a heartfelt love letter to his first family behind the camera, the stunt crew. From Colt's impassioned monologue about how messed up it is that there's no Oscar category for stunts, to the sheer simple act of making their dangerous work visible, Leitch shines a light on the crew members who put their lives on the line to make movies. He calls attention to stunt protocol, all the thumbs ups, and delivering action sequences that are pure giddy popcorn entertainment. The Fall Guy is a peek behind the curtain of movie making, giving audiences a glimpse of how the sausage gets made, nailing the industry's peculiar sense of monotony and high stakes. It also romanticizes life on the set, the exhausted late-night conversations, the adrenaline rush of nailing a oneer, and the harried excitement of operating a camera on a rig amidst a crowd scene. Every frame is a testament to Leitch's love for movies, and a reminder of why we should love them and the people who make them too. This meta Ouroboros movie within a movie structure only works because The Fall Guy is such unabashed fun packaged in solid, old-fashioned filmmaking. That's not to say there's no real stakes. There are, certainly more than many franchise films where characters seem to have 9+ lives. But The Fall Guy wants to celebrate the blockbuster, not shame it. And it does so with a wickedly smart script from Drew Pearce. The movie has one of the most divinely ridiculous, satisfying examples of planting and payoff in recent memory. The Fall Guy offers a potent blend of action and romance, as refreshing as one of its touted spicy margaritas. Sure, it's got a little kick, but mostly it exists to ensure that anyone who consumes it has a fantastic time. That was the review of The Fall Guy. It was by Maureen Lee Lanker, and she's giving the movie a grade of A. Next on the must list is the idea of you. Temperatures are rising, so indulge in the boy band bliss and age gap romance of this Robin Lee novel adaptation. This is a Prime Video film, and I have the review of it right here also. Anne Hathaway and Nicholas Galitzine smolder in age gap romance. This is also by Maureen Lee Lanker. The idea of you is Skittles-infused vodka in movie form. That is to say, it has a candy pop appeal that will have viewers tossing it back as if there's no tomorrow, only to then be walloped by its adult substance. Based on the novel of the same name by Robin Lee, the film, out now on Prime Video, follows Anne Hathaway's art dealer, Solene, newly turned 40, and her unlikely romance with a 24-year-old boy bander, Hayes Campbell, played by Nicholas Galitzine. When Solene takes her daughter Izzy, played by Ella Rubin, to Coachella, she accidentally ends up in Hayes' trailer. Good luck to anyone with a VIP pass who thinks they can do it, striking up a connection with the hunky Brit. But when he shows up at her Los Angeles art gallery the next week and buys everything in it, he makes clear his intentions to take things beyond a cheeky mid-show wink. Soon, Celine is falling headlong into his world, jet-setting to New York and around the world while Izzy is at summer camp. But fragile relationships can only withstand the pressures of the outside world for so long. Plenty have judged the idea of you before even seeing it, labeling it Harry Styles fan fiction with a derisive snort. It's true that Hayes and Harry have much in common, including their penchant for tattoos and heartthrob status. And unless you've been living under a rock, it's impossible to miss the winking nods to One Direction, though kudos to director Michael Showalter for delivering a fictional boy band who can dance better than the real McCoy. But both the text and the performances are far more nuanced and emotional than the implications of those who use such a label. Yes, the idea of you is a hell of a lot of fun, a soapy May-December romance about getting her groove back, suburban mom, and a guy a few years removed from the cover of Tiger Beat. It luxuriates in itself, be it the genuinely catchy bops that Hayes' band August Moon performs, or stolen kisses on private beaches. August Moon and Hayes Campbell are constructed with more care than some actual bands and music artists today. Their music videos and Coachella set meticulously choreographed and executed. But exuberant playfulness does not rob something of meaning, and thankfully, that's something Showalter, who we know from Search Party and Spoiler Alert, his co-writer Jennifer Westfeldt from Kissing Jessica Stein, and the cast understand. Hathaway is radiant, the earnest, twinkling energy that endeared her to audiences with her debut in The Princess Diaries returning full throttle, with the bumps and bruises of age and experience offering richer colors and deeper shades. It's not difficult to see why any man, age 24 or 54, would be immediately charmed by her. Her wide movie star smile barely conceals the sincere, try-hard energy that both set her on an early path to success and led to years of undeserved internet scorn and abuse. In Hathaway's hands, Solene is a softer, crunchier version than the woman on the page, trading her Range Rover and Malibu pad for a Subaru and a Craftsman-style home in Silver Lake. Her romance with Hayes is every bit as sweeping and taboo as it is on the page, perhaps even more so given that Hayes' world of private jets, Tag Heuer watches, and vacation homes in the south of France is so far from Celine's own. This is also part of Showalter's deft touch as a director. His spaces always feel lived in and true, as if one could walk into this character's house or art gallery tomorrow. Hathaway's Celine is relatable rather than aspirational. She is truly living a fantasy with Hayes, one that is complicated by her age and awareness that she'll be judged and dissected for daring to fall for a younger man. Hathaway perfectly threads the needle, vacillating between the intoxicating allure of her romance with Hayes and the harsher cost of such a relationship. In some ways, Celine is an opportunity for Hathaway to address the misogyny she's faced in her career, to dig into a role that is about a woman's embracing her sexuality and her joy at an age where she's expected to fade into the background. With Celine, Hathaway proclaims her ownership over her body, her career choices, and her refusal to let others steal her joy. Gallatzine is the ideal co-star. His cut glass cheekbones and sleepy eyes, the epitome of boy band beauty. Still, it is Gallatzine's more soulful side, the inquisitive intelligence in his acting choices, that makes his Hayes so enchanting. He's both enigmatic and familiar, someone who feels capable of deeply vulnerable conversations while remaining unknowable. When Hayes does open up to Celine and show her parts of himself the world will never know, he's at his most irresistible. There's some of Harry Styles' impishness in his choices, but by and large, he makes Hayes entirely his own. Nowadays, we rarely mint new movie stars, but Gallatzine could break that mold. Between this, Red, White, and Royal Blue, George and Mary, and Bottoms, Gallatzine is on the cusp of something big, and at the very least, he's proved himself a curious and agile actor. Not the least because his chemistry with his co-stars feels so effortless. He and Hathaway positively crackle together, from his slow, crooked grin when they first meet to the way she tugs on his bottom lip in their first kiss. Gallatzine knows how to touch someone for maximum effect, the gentle but firm cupping of Hathaway's jaw and the smooth caress of her hips. The intimacy here is palpable and genuinely sexy, something sorely absent in many of today's screen romances. Showalter's direction grants the film an eroticism without ever showing us more than a hint of bare bottom. This is what critics mean when they yearn for the movies to be sexy again. The erotic is not in exposed skin, but in the brush of fingers, a meaningful glance, or the arch of a throat in the throes of ecstasy. The film's one misstep comes in its central conflict. While the tabloids still expose Celine and Hayes, labeling her a cougar and installing cameras outside her house, the whole thing feels rather toothless. Most of it plays out in dizzying montage and is dispensed with quickly, but the ways in which the press invades Celine's life should feel life-destroying. The offhand comments of high school mean girls have more of an impact on Celine than the invasiveness that comes with dating a global superstar. While it's meant to emphasize that Celine makes choices to protect her daughter, it also muddies the impact of this romance on her inner life. Her decisions feel more rooted in matriarchal sacrifice than anything else, which minimizes her choice to protect not just her family, but also herself. The idea of you understands that sometimes heartbreak is the cost of something brief and beautiful, but the novel does a better job of allowing Celine to arrive at that decision on her own terms. Still, this is a minor quibble for a movie that is otherwise a delight of the highest order. It's clear those behind the idea of you hold a genuine affection and care for the story, rather than the ironic eye that a book like this could so easily invite from a lesser team. The Idea of You is a coming-of-middle-age tale and an earnest, cathartic love letter to unexpected connection and throwing social pressure to the wind in pursuit of something real. We may have fallen in love with the idea of this movie, but blissfully, the reality is even better. That was the review by Maureen Lee Lanker of The Idea of You, and she's giving the movie a grade of B+. Next on our must list, Hiramandi, The Diamond Bazaar. Award-winning Indian director Sanjay Leela Bhansali goes Bollywood big with his first ever streaming project, an 8-episode Netflix musical drama set in 1940s Lahore. This lavish tale of dueling courtesans, played by Manisha Koirala and Sonakshi Sinha, tragic young lovers, played by Sharmeen Sehgal and Taha Shah Badusha, and India's fight for independence from Britain, is as engrossing as it is epic. Dua Lipa's radical optimism. Since her epic opening performance at the Grammys in February, I've been counting down the days until the singer's third studio album release. Launched with singles Houdini and Training Season, the 11-track record is sure to provide splashy pop hits for the summer that's right around the corner. And bonus, she's host and musical guest on Saturday Night Live this weekend. Our last item on the must list is Hacks. Deborah Vance, played by Jean Smart, and Ava Daniels, played by Hannah Einbinder, tackle their biggest career opportunity yet in season 3. Flawless guest casting, quality antics with Jimmy, played by Paul W. Downs, and Kayla, played by Megan Stalter, and a cutthroat season-ending cliffhanger prove that the Max comedy is aging as beautifully as its star. The first 2 episodes are streaming now. Whew, that's a lot. The Fall Guy, Hacks, and The Idea of You lead this week's must list, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. As a sidebar article to The Fall Guy, here is everything you need to know about that Fall Guy post-credits scene. The Ryan Gosling action comedy ends with a delightful throwback. This is by Devin Coggan. And there's a warning here that this story contains spoilers for The Fall Guy. A few familiar faces make a cameo at the end of The Fall Guy. David Leitch's action blockbuster stars Ryan Gosling as a stuntman named Colt Seavers, who agrees to return for one last job to support his ex-girlfriend Jody, played by Emily Blunt, in her directorial debut. The film is loosely based on the 1980s television series of the same name, which ran on ABC from 1981 to 1986, and starred Lee Majors and Heather Thomas. In a fun crossover, the 85-year-old Majors and the 66-year-old Thomas make a cameo at the end of the film, popping up in a post-credits scene. The Fall Guy ends with the reveal that A-list actor Tom Ryder, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, and his producer, Gail, played by Hannah Waddingham, were attempting to frame Colt for murder. They try to escape via helicopter, only to crash and be arrested by 2 police officers played by Majors and Thomas. The original show starred Majors, best known for The $6 Million Man, as a stuntman, also named Colt Seavers, who used his on-set expertise to moonlight as a bounty hunter, catching criminals with his extensive knowledge of explosives and driving maneuvers. Thomas also starred as fellow stuntwoman Jody Banks, often accompanying Colt on his adventures. Majors also sang the show's theme song, Unknown Stuntman, which is covered in the film by Blake Shelton. In a previous interview with Entertainment Weekly, Leitch and his wife and producing partner Kelly McCormick revealed that they were original fans of the Fall Guy TV show, praising its impressive stunts and how it lit the fuse for a new generation of stunt performers. It showed the skills Major's character had, McCormick said. He was outwitting everybody and not really believed to be anybody who could get anything done. And then he ended up getting everything done in the nick of time. And they actually achieved really big practical stunts every week. The Fall Guy is in theaters now. That is everything you need to know about that Fall Guy's post-credits scene, and it was by Devin Coggan. From our TV section, I have a review, but it's a little bit longer. It'll take us past our midway point, so I will mention right now that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. So this TV review is about A Man in Full. Jeff Daniels chews the scenery in this laughable drama. Netflix's 6-part adaptation of Tom Wolfe's novel is a Southern fried mess. This is by Kristen Baldwin. When Tom Wolfe released A Man in Full, the highly anticipated follow-up to The Bonfire of the Vanities, in 1998, most reviews couldn't help but marvel at the sheer sprawl of the 742-page novel's narrative. The New York Times noted that the story of A Man in Full does not really lend itself to simple summary, while Time magazine described it as being swollen with subplots. Former Entertainment Weekly editor Mark Harris begged Hollywood to spare us the terrible film that this juicily unadaptable tome will inevitably become. To its credit, Hollywood waited more than a quarter century before bestowing its adaptation of Wolfe's unadaptable work on the public. But Netflix's A Man in Full, created by mega producer David E. Kelley and starring the usually unassailable Jeff Daniels, is still awful. Even with 6 hours of runtime to play with, the limited series fails to corral Wolfe's far-reaching tale of money, class, and racial justice into anything coherent, instead ping-ponging between over-the-top soap opera and somber social commentary. Charlie Croker, played by Daniels, is a pillar of Atlanta society, a former Georgia Tech football star turned filthy rich real estate developer whose ego looms over the ATL in the form of a garish skyscraper called Croker Concourse. Jetting around on his private plane with his much younger second wife, Serena, played by Sarah Jones, on his arm, Charlie Croker is untouchable. That is, until a pugnacious banker named Harry Zale, played by Bill Camp, and his self-loathing loan officer, Raymond Peepgrass, played by Tom Pelfrey, come to collect the $800 million Charlie owes their institution. Not only must Charlie's lawyer, Roger Hill, played by Emil Amin, help his boss out of his financial mess, he also finds himself representing Conrad Hensley, played by John Michael Hill, the husband of Charlie's assistant, Jill, played by Chante Adams, who is arrested for defending himself against a violent police officer, played by Scott Daniel Johnson, during a traffic stop. "Whole lot of huffing and puffing and bluffing going on," scoffs Harry Zale during one of his contentious meetings with Charlie. It's an apt summary for A Man in Full, which uses its central trio to explore several facets of modern masculinity. Charlie, a toxic titan of industry, Raymond, a milquetoast striver, and Roger, who traded moral purpose for a high paycheck. Fans of Wolfe's novel should be prepared for several deviations from the original, especially with Conrad's story, which takes a far more conventional path. But plenty of plot points remained intact. Charlie still brings important guests, played by Josh Pace and Andrea Frankel, on an ill-fated trip to the horse-breeding barn at his plantation. He still gets those massive saddlebag-shaped sweat stains on his dress shirts when under pressure, and his bum knee still needs surgery. Raymond, meanwhile, remains entangled in a legal fight over child support with Suja, played by Aline Powell, a Finnish bombshell he impregnated. Kelly's changes seem aimed at consolidating some of the subplots in Wolfe's tale, which is understandable, but the individual elements of the story aren't really the problem with A Man in Full. Instead, it's the challenge of translating Wolfe's singular style of prose. Vivid, elaborate, effusive, ornamental, which thrives on the page but can devolve into cartoonish farce on screen. Matching the spirit and vigor of Wolfe's words creates a temptation to go big, real big. This manifests in many ways, including several Kelly-approved stylistic flourishes, like on-the-nose needle drops and comically histrionic sex scenes. Thomas Schlaim and Regina King direct 3 episodes each. But mostly, it comes through in the leading man's scenery-chewing performance. Daniels, sporting an atrocious two-toned hairpiece, belts his lines in an accent that lands somewhere between Foghorn Leghorn and Gomer Pyle. Yes, I'm old. It can be funny in small doses, as when he and Crump go at each other in the bank's conference room, the buttons on their dress shirts straining as they shout and glower across the table with stormy brows. But 6 hours is about 5 doses too many. Pelfrey, his handsome features, poorly disguised by a greasy side part and oversized glasses, smirks and sniggers with exaggerated enthusiasm at Charlie's misfortune when he's not bursting into fits of impotent rage. William Jackson Harper puts his back into the role of Mayor Wes Jordan, a charismatic and ambitious political prodigy, but can't quite summon the calculating menace required for his particular storyline. It pains me to inform you that Diane Lane and Lucy Liu are also in A Man in Full, only because the series thoroughly, shamefully wastes them on underdeveloped characters. Lane plays Charlie's first wife, Martha, who fills her divorced days rattling around an empty mansion and doing step aerobics before entering into an extremely improbable flirtation with Raymond Peepgrass. Lou is Martha's friend Joyce Newman, the polished CEO of a successful beauty brand who gets dragged into Charlie's dealings with Major Jordan. Still, she only has a handful of substantive scenes. Lucy freaking Lou. She deserves better. I understand Kelly didn't set out to make A Man in Full and The Women Who Hate Him, but after spending 6 hours with Charlie Croker, I can say with certainty that he should have. A Man in Full premiered Thursday, May 2nd on Netflix. That was the review by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving the show a grade of D. We heard that there's a summer preview at Entertainment Weekly, and I have this article from the summer preview section. Will Smith and Martin Lawrence promise Bad Boys, Ride or Die, is what a summer movie is supposed to be. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. And there's a note here that Entertainment Weekly's 2024 summer preview has dozens of exclusive looks at the most anticipated TV shows, movies, books, and music of entertainment's hottest season. We can continue to visit EW.com throughout May for more previews of what we'll be watching, reading, and listening to in the months to come. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when fate comes for you. That twist on the classic lyrics is what brought Will Smith and Martin Lawrence back for Bad Boys, Ride or Die, their third time reteaming since first starring together in Bad Boys nearly 30 years ago. I'm very excited about this one, Smith tells Entertainment Weekly about the fourth installment in the Buddy Cop franchise. We want it to feel nostalgic, but we also want the characters to be experiencing things that are age-appropriate and experience-appropriate. It's a challenge to keep it fun and keep it exciting and make sure that the popcorn part is enjoyable, but also letting it be gourmet popcorn. It's popcorn, but it's definitely got some special sauce on it. Bad Boys Ride or Die in theaters June 7th flips the script on career detectives Mike, played by Smith, and Marcus, played by Lawrence, forcing them to work on the other side of the law when their late captain, played by Joe Pantoliano, who died in a shocking twist in 2020's Bad Boys for Life, is posthumously framed in a massive corruption conspiracy. The duo must go on the run to clear his name and legacy, as well as their own reputations. And Smith promises, it's what a summer movie is supposed to be. That's the thing that is important in making another one. It has to have an emotional base that is interesting and riveting, not just trying to blow some stuff up, Smith explains. At this point in my life, I need the movies to be about something. Part of why Bad Boys works for people is at the heart of it is its friendship. At the heart of it is love. At the heart of it is a relationship, and it's the kind of relationship that we all wish we had. somebody that will ride or die with us and for us. But 3 decades later, that friendship has to evolve. We're trying to expand on what that would mean at this age when people start growing apart and they start wanting different things, Smith says. You've got 30 years worth of friendship that, for me, it is important in these movies that it gets jeopardized, and there is some part of it that has a deeper idea about life, about love, about friendship, about fear. And this one is about fate. And what is the part that fate actually plays in the building of a friendship, in a building of a life? While Smith doesn't want to give away the big surprise, he does reveal that Mike is feeling really deep guilt over the loss of Captain Howard, and both of the characters are going through really powerful changes in their lives. Lawrence teases that Marcus will be acting differently than he ever has before. Each one of these films provides something new and different, Lawrence says. This time, Marcus has an experience that allows him to be bolder and take more risks, so we see him in a lot of situations that aren't as safe as in previous films. One of those unsafe situations comes about in a comedic way, where Mike and Marcus get caught up in a convenience store robbery. I think by this film, everyone knows Marcus loves his snacks, Lawrence says. Mike and Marcus were on their way out and running late, but Marcus needs snacks and nobody's going to get in the way of that. Marcus has Mike pull over so I can run into the store, and just when Marcus is about to get the goods, the store gets held up, so Marcus has to handle business. While the movie continues to deliver the comedic action fans have come to love from this franchise, it also raises the dramatic stakes by reframing Captain Howard's legacy as a potential dirty cop, and as a result, Mike and Marcus's careers are put in jeopardy. We went back and looked at the 3 movies and laid in the storyline of the 4th movie from things set up in the previous movies, Smith says. Captain Howard was working on a case that he had mentioned in Bad Boys 2, so the movie picks up on things that were just tiny seeds in Bad Boys 2 and Bad Boys 3. Captain Howard's character is being framed with 20 years of crimes and work with cartels, and his entire legacy is being destroyed by rogue factions within the Miami PD, and in the process, the bad boys are also framed. When Mike and Marcus ultimately go on the run, they turn to an unlikely ally. Mike's newly discovered criminal son, Armando, played by Jacob Scipio, who first appeared in the 3rd movie. Mike Lowry's son plays a really critical part in saving the legacy of the bad boys and of Captain Howard, Smith says. Jacob better get ready to have a really, really good summer because his life is never going to be the same after this movie. He has such a powerful role in this film. Because Armando has extensive knowledge of the cartels due to being raised believing his father was a criminal, Mike convinces his incarcerated son to help him bring down the cartels and clear his name. In the process, that purifies their relationship, Smith says. Mike is trying to repair his past with his son and the loss of the captain. And there's even a sense that Mike has that he might be cursed. He says, "Bad S happens to everybody I love," and it's part of why he had a difficult time having any love and any friendships other than Marcus. So this is about him trying to develop a ride-or-die relationship with his son, too. With so many emotional stakes on the line for their characters and the franchise as a whole, Smith and Lawrence are relieved that they were able to finish filming this movie despite multiple production delays. We started making this movie prior to both the writer's strike and the actor's strike, and we didn't know if we were going to be shut down full-time and when, Lawrence says. Once we were shut down and came home, we didn't know when we were going to be back. It was great to finally finish this film and get it to the fans. What you have here in this movie is a true labor of love. Or fate. That was Will Smith and Martin Lawrence promise Bad Boys Ride or Die is what a summer movie is supposed to be, and it was by Sidney Buxbaum. Next, Ethan Hawke reveals why Denzel Washington whispered it was better he lost at the 2002 Oscars. This is by Sydney Buxbaum. Is it really an honor just to be nominated? According to Denzel Washington's advice to Ethan Hawke, it's actually better to lose at the Oscars. Back in 2002, the Training Day co-stars were both nominated for an Academy Award. Washington was up for the Best Actor prize, while Hawke was competing for Best Supporting Actor. Washington went on to win his Oscar, but Hawke lost to Jim Broadbent for his role in Iris. And according to Hawke, after he lost, Washington leaned over to whisper that it's better to lose the Oscar. You don't want an award to improve your status, you want to improve the award's status, Hawke explained during his appearance on Who's Talking to Chris Wallace on Max to discuss his new movie, Wildcats. That's the way he thinks, and that's what I'm talking about playing with Babe Ruth. Hawke previously compared acting with Washington to what it would be like to play baseball with Ruth. I think when all is said and done, he's the greatest actor of our generation, he said. The Academy Award has more power because Denzel has a couple. It didn't elevate who he was. All that being said, would Hawke have rather won the Oscar more than 20 years ago? No, he said. I mean, yeah, I guess. I was at the Oscars sitting next to Denzel Washington and nominated against Ian McKellen. I had already won. It was impossible for me not to see it any other way. That was Ethan Hawke revealing why Denzel Washington whispered it was better he lost at the 2002 Oscars, and it was by Sydney Buxbaum. We heard a lot about Ryan Gosling's Fall Guy. Here's an article about how Ryan Gosling wants a do-over on one more La La Land scene. There's a moment that haunts me. This is by Dustin Nelson. When La La Land sang and danced its way into theaters in 2016, it became a critical and box office hit while collecting a record-tying 14 Oscar nominations. But for all the film's success, leading man Ryan Gosling would like a do-over. In a new video interview with Wall Street Journal magazine, the Fall Guy and Barbie star admits that there's one part of his Oscar-nominated performance that he wishes he could take back. There's a moment that haunts me where we're dancing, Emma Stone and I, he says. I didn't know this would become the poster for the movie. After taking a deep breath, he continues, we were supposed to have our hands up, and I thought it'd be cool to put my hand like that, he says, positioning his hand at somewhat a flat angle rather than gesturing skyward with a straight line from his arm. With a straight line from his arm through to his fingertips. Even though everyone told me it wasn't cool, I was sure that a flat hand was cooler than pointing up. Now, when I look at it, and I have to see it all the time, you know what would have been cooler than this? And he makes his hand flat. That. And he makes his hand go skyward in the interview. When the moment crystallized as the instantly recognizable movie poster, it became more than just a decision in the scene. It just killed the energy that way, Gosling laments. It was sort of like, all leading to what? It was just a lazy, I call it la-la hand. Told that dancers have a term for a similar awkward gesture, hamburger hands, Gosling admits that it's news to him despite his having some dance experience prior to shooting the movie. I thought it would help in La La Land, he says, of his dancing background. Then, of course, hamburger hands Gosling over here. It didn't help me at all in the end. Gosling discusses La La Land further in the accompanying Wall Street Journal magazine article, citing the Damien Chazelle-directed film as one of the first he took on with his children and longtime partner Ava Mendez in mind. I don't really take roles that are going to put me in some kind of dark place, he says. This moment is what I feel like trying to read the room at home and feel like, what is going to be the best for all of us. The decisions I make them with Ava, and we make them with our family in mind first. He adds, I think La La Land was the first. It was just sort of like, oh, this would be fun for them too, because even though they're not coming to set, we're practicing piano every day, or we're dancing, or we're singing. We can watch the video that's referenced in the article at the Entertainment Weekly website for this story, which was Ryan Gosling wants a do-over on one La La Land scene. There's a moment that haunts me. And that was by Dustin Nelson. Jerry Seinfeld has a new movie out, and this article says Jerry Seinfeld would welcome Kellogg's lawsuit over Pop-Tart movie Unfrosted. I would love that trial. This is by Mike Miller. Nearly three decades after his generation-defining sitcom went off air, Jerry Seinfeld is finally starring in his first live-action movie, and yes, it's about Pop-Tarts. In some ways, it makes sense. His love for cereal was well known on Seinfeld, where boxes lined his cabinets and he was often seen munching on a bowl. His famous Pop-Tart joke, told on his 2020 comedy special 23 Hours to Kill, had been gestating for at least a decade. He spoke about writing the bit in a 2012 New York Times video where he said he'd been refining it for 2 years. Usually, he explained, it takes a couple of days. So the interest was always there, but Seinfeld has written no shortage of jokes in his storied career. Why this joke? Why now? And what made him want to write, star, and direct when he's never really done any of those things before for a feature film? Entertainment Weekly put those questions and more to the man himself about the release of Netflix's Unfrosted, which hits the streaming service on May 3rd. Very loosely based on the true story of the invention of the famous toaster pastry, the movie plays out like the breakfast version of The Right Stuff, with Kellogg's and Post cereal engaged in a cutthroat race to upend the American breakfast. Featuring as many cameos as it does breakfast puns, Unfrosted's cast also includes Amy Schumer as Marjorie Merriweather Post, head of Post cereal, Jim Gaffigan as Edsel Kellogg III, head of Kellogg's, Hugh Grant as Thurl Ravenscroft, the actor cast as Tony the Tiger, Bill Purr as President John F. Kennedy, and Mikey Day, Kyle Mooney, and Drew Tarver as Snap, Crackle, and Pop, respectively. Melissa McCarthy co-stars as Seinfeld's co-worker at Kellogg's, while Dan Levy, James Marsden, Jack McBrayer, Thomas Lennon, Bobby Moynihan, Fred Armiston, and Tony Hale, and many others appear. Here, Seinfeld reveals the correct way to eat a Pop-Tart, whether he has plans to do more acting, and why Unfrosted is the opposite of Barbie. And most importantly, what's the deal with breakfast? The first question is, I guess the obvious question is, what made you want to make a movie about Pop-Tarts? There's a gift with every tragedy. There's a little blessing inside. And what this is what I got out of COVID. I would never have done this if I wasn't sitting around for a month doing nothing and having my friend, Seinfeld writer Spike Ferriston, say, let's do a screenplay. We got nothing else to do. I never would have agreed to it otherwise. What made you want to direct this yourself? Just easier. It's just easier when you're in the writer's room, like on a TV series, and then you walk down to the set with the script. Having a director interpret what the writers were trying to do is such a waste of time, and it goes wrong. The writer knows what he wants. The reason writers don't direct is because they're usually not able to communicate with other humans. They can just write. But luckily, I've developed those skills over many years of trying, and I can talk to other people and say, no, the idea of this joke is you say it this way. And that's all directing is. Is there anything that was harder or easier about the process than you were anticipating? Yeah. The thing that's harder is when you're making a movie for Netflix and they give you a healthy budget, which they did, there's nothing you can't do. The technology enables you to do absolutely anything you can think of, and that can kind of stall your brain out because if you can do anything, there's no way to make a choice of what do we do. We actually had a car chase scene in here in one of the early drafts with cars driven by kids, and it was going to be an exact duplicate of the car chase from Bullet on the streets of San Francisco, but it ended up being a little too much to shoot. But you can do that. If you want to do that, you can do that. They'll let you do it, and you can do it. What was it like starring in this and directing yourself? How does that work? It's a little tricky, but luckily I have so little interest in acting that I never had to worry about my performance. In fact, in some scenes, I'm not even bothering to act. I'm just watching the other actors, which I did on the TV series quite a bit. If you look at my face on the TV series, I'm just watching as a writer going, yeah, that was a good joke. I like how that joke landed very nicely. Considering your feelings about acting, what made you want to star in this? Again, it's just easier. It's just easier. I know how to do that line. Let me just do it. So, tell me about Breakfast and your fascination with it. In the 60s, and I guess to a certain extent today, it's the only thing that as a kid you totally control. The other food throughout the day, you're manhandled by adults. But breakfast is yours. You can do whatever you want, and everything at breakfast is so fantastic. French toast and cereal and cinnamon rolls. It's all the greatest things in the world, and you're really hungry. The hungriest you ever are throughout the day is breakfast. You have an incredible cast in this. What was it like on set? Was there a lot of improvising? Quite a bit of improvising. Kyle Dunnigan completely improvised Walter Cronkite. Bill Burr completely improvised JFK. Those were the most improvised two scenes in the movie. The rest of it is mostly the script. Was there anyone you really wanted to get that it didn't work out for you, for whatever reason? There were a lot of people who didn't work out, mostly due to scheduling, but nobody just flat turned us down. Well, there were a couple. It was the usual casting process. Some people were intimidated by the JFK part. They thought it was going to be like Lincoln, that it would take me months to prepare. And I'm trying to explain, no, this is not Lincoln. Bill got it. And Bill, of course, is a comedian. Got that right away. No acting. Just be fun, Bill. Did you use any of your favorite comedy movies as a reference? I watched Blazing Saddles the other day just for something to watch, and I was really kind of shocked when it started that it felt like Unfrosted, which was not intentional, but there's an idiotic reality in that movie that does not disturb what you think is a real story. When the Count Basie band is just playing in the middle of the desert, that's the ravioli coming to life. It's like, well, that didn't happen, but nobody cares. And I was very excited that I thought, oh, I'm in the world of Blazing Saddles a bit here, which, of course, is one of my favorite comedies of all time. And I also love The In-Laws, and I love Peter Sellers. He was really my biggest comedy hero, period. There's one moment in the funeral scene where the widow is watching this ridiculous full serial honors going on, and she says to me, did you plan this? And I say to her, I don't know, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie. And we had a lot of fights about it. It makes absolutely no sense, but it's the only moment where I felt a tiny bit like Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau. What was Big Cereal's involvement in this? Did you get any of this cleared up with the Pop-Tarts people? This movie is the opposite of Barbie. Barbie is made by Mattel. Kellogg's had no idea and would never allow us to do anything like this. And if we don't get sued, it'll be a miracle. We thought that'd be phenomenal publicity if we do get sued. I mean, walking in court with lawyers to defend myself that I made fun of the Pop-Tart in a way that's inappropriate? I would love that trial. That's the only possible sequel, is to be on trial for Pop-Tart judges. What's your relationship with the Pop-Tart today? Pure love, okay? Unmitigated adoration. You'll still eat a Pop-Tart today? A box of Pop-Tarts is something you can find in your house? Yeah, I love them. They taste like nothing, but there's something about them. They taste like nothing. See? That's another thing people say. Why is that funny? The badness is the goodness, right? What is the proper way to eat a Pop-Tart? Frosted or unfrosted? Toasted or untoasted? Toasted. Has to be toasted. I don't agree with the raw Pop-Tart at all. The trouble that they went through to make it toastable. By the way, they did really catch on fire. That really was one of the problems they were having. And the crimping of the edge to keep the jelly in was a big problem. The jelly was coming out in the toaster, so they went to a lot of effort so that you could toast it. So toast it. How much research did this involve? There was no desire to get anything right. We just wanted to make it. So when you look up who was the voice of Tony the Tiger and you find out the guy's actual name is Thurl Ravenscroft, then you look up at the comedy gods and say, thank you for that one. Are there any other bits from your stand-up that you think could be blown out like this into a movie? Oh my God, don't you think one's enough? People are going to want more. It's outrageous. It's outrageous to think you could do such a thing. Very egomaniacal. Do you have any other acting projects on the horizon? I've never planned anything. I didn't plan the TV series. I didn't plan Comedians in Cars. I didn't plan this. I have no plans. I never make plans. I'm just a comedian, and if something happens that looks good, I might try to do it. But otherwise, there are no plans ever. That was Jerry Seinfeld would welcome Kellogg's lawsuit over Pop-Tart movie, Unfrosted. I would love that trial. And it was by Mike Miller. Before I go toast a Pop-Tart, and yes, I have some, I will thank you all for listening this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury, and you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This has been Entertainment Weekly, and I've been reading from their website, EW.com. Please come back next week to hear what I've found next. And until then, goodbye.